The case of Ronica Ann Guidry, case number 80156. And this is the time set for oral argument. Good afternoon. And Ms. Dickinson, how much time would you need for a rebuttal? All right, that'll be the order. Whenever you're ready to proceed, we'll hear arguments.
I want to thank the court for allowing us to argue here.
Sure.
Okay. Am I allowed to take off my mask? Or not?
I believe you are. Yes. While you're arguing, you can.
Okay. May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dickinson. I represent Ronica Guidry. Ronica was convicted of second-degree murder, robbery, grand larceny, and duty to stop at the scene of a crash involving death or injury. The jury rejected part of the original charges, which were first-degree murder with use of a deadly weapon, the car, and robbery with a deadly weapon. Ronica received a sentence of 18 years to life. It was a very serious case. Now, if the jury had been accurately and completely instructed on her defenses, they may not have returned these verdicts. But that was not the only error that occurred in this case. Other errors occurring included prosecutorial misconduct in opening and closing. There was an error in the court limiting voir dire, not allowing questions with regard to prostitution. There was the omission of irrelevant, gruesome photographs. There was an error in the endorsement and the presentation of the state's expert, Detective Salisbury. And then, of course, we have a Fourth Amendment issue. Fourth Amendment was violated by an unreasonable search and seizure, and the evidence recovered was used against Ronica at trial. Thus, there was cumulative error, and there was even error in sentencing. At sentencing, the court considered and relied on jailhouse calls between Ronica and her family and her children to conclude that she was not taking responsibility for her actions. But let me briefly digress into the facts. The evidence presented by the state showed that Eduardo Osorio and Ronica Guidry met at a casino, and she gave him a ride. Ronica's attorney admitted Ronica was involved in prostitution at the time.
Ms. Dickinson, I'm going to jump right in because I'm pretty clear of the facts.
Okay.
My question is, when I read the transcripts on the settling of instructions, it appeared that there were several different points in the trial prior to closing arguments that instructions were discussed. And early on, Mr. Mueller was saying, look, I've still got a necessity instruction, hold off on settling these. And then we get to the final instructions, and it appears that Mr. Mueller abandons the necessity instruction and whatever self-defense instructions he was going to propose.
Mr. Mueller did propose a necessity instruction, assault instruction, and self-defense orally, and the court said, I'll take those under submission.
Where is that on the site?
I'd have to look at the record. I can give it to the court after I sit down and come back.
You can do
However,
that.
The next day when they came back in, he did not argue those again.
It appears that he accepted the run-in instructions, and that's what they went with.
He didn't challenge a lot of the instructions. You are correct. And I'm arguing plain error on a lot of these instructions, and I think the error is plain because basically her whole defense was taken away. I mean, he argued her defense, but the jury instructions aren't there. I mean, he argued basically necessity, but there's no instruction on necessity. He argued self-defense. There's no instruction. And I think that the court could have intervened, or he could have submitted something more. But the person who ends up being harmed here is Ms. Guidry, because he did the argument, but he just didn't do the instructions.
Could I, on instruction number 23, for example, the second sentence, a person who has taken property may not rely upon self-defense when the need to utilize force is in response to the victim, I'm going to ellipses, seeking to prevent the escape with the property. So your argument is that sentence essentially gutted the self-defense instructions that were given.
That were given, yes.
And you're asking us, there was no objection to the second sentence in this instruction, but you're saying giving it this way was plain error and undermined the defense in a way that the district court should have interdicted on its own? Is that the argument?
That's correct. That's what I'm saying. Is that okay. The Carter and the Crawford case instruct the court to sua sponte, correct any errors in jury instructions. And so I'm arguing that the court should have, because the defense of property under NRS 193.240 allows a person to use resistance sufficient to prevent an illegal attempt by force to take property in his lawful position, a possession. The plain meaning of this means that if you're going to try to recover your property, you can only do it during or before the time of the taking. And the way this sentence is read and how all the jury instructions were, it allowed Osorio to jump on top of the hood of Ronica's car and shatter her windshield. Witnesses say they thought he was trying to get inside the car on the driver's side. Clearly, this was a terrifying situation. She stopped when he jumped in front of her, and then this occurred. Now, it makes sense that we would not allow people to go ahead and do violence in order to get property back. Just as a public policy matter, we would want them to call the police rather than start damaging a car. But if the court feels that he was allowed to use force, that force would have to be reasonable. And there was no instruction on that.
Also, I wanted to ask both the prosecution and yourself, looking at instruction number 11, this is not a stock instruction. This looks like an instruction that's just kind of put together. And this is kind of the instruction that you're having a problem with in your brief. My question is, the state charges only felony murder one. They don't charge open murder. They pled only felony murder under the theory of robbery. Then, when you look at instruction 11, would it be your claim then, because at the beginning of trial, the clerk of the court tells the jury the indictment, reads the indictment, grand larceny, felony, leaving the scene of an accident, felony. When you look at instruction number 11, it's under sub 2, an unintentional killing committed in the prosecution of felonious intent. If you take just that and the fact that they had a question, would you say that this is an error under these particular facts because two other felonies were pled and there's no direction as to what they are, but that they could come back with murder too based on this instruction?
Yes, I would agree this is error. And the state in their brief said there was no evidence to support this theory. So it should not have even been introduced in there because you're right, there were other felonies the jury could have relied on. And they certainly were confused at one point. And so if they did rely on this and the state's saying there wasn't any evidence for it, clearly there's error for the murder charge, second degree murder charge. Did that answer the question?
So it's an error of law based under these facts?
It's an error of law, and I guess it's also a change of theory, as the court was saying, because they didn't plead it in the original indictment or information. Aside from the jury instructions, there is another issue I wanted to talk about briefly, and that's prosecutorial misconduct. In this case, in opening statements, the prosecutor stood up and made statements that were disproved by the police reports and by his own witnesses. In his opening statement, the prosecutor said that Osorio jumped out in front of her car, put his hands on her hood, and said, "Stop, I want my watch back." Now, the prosecutor knew this statement could not be true because he had put the witnesses on at the grand jury and none of them could identify what Osorio said. And also at trial, One witness said, we don't know what he said, didn't speak English, spoke a different thing, different language. Defense objected, and then the prosecutor doubled down and said, this is all what the evidence is going to show. So why would he argue that? I suspect he would argue that because he had a weak case for felony robbery, he had a weak case for robbery, and he wanted the jury to believe from the very inception that Osorio was trying to get her his watch back, and that's why he was shattering her windshield. But there was no evidence to show what he was saying. Also in the opening, he was expressing personal opinion as to the videos and argument. At one time, the court said that you're teetering on argument. He was not teetering. He was way over the line. We had errors in closing, rebuttal, where facts were misstated. There were no objections for those. There were objections to the opening, though. And all this was prejudicial to Ms. Gertie getting a fair trial. I think I've used my 10 minutes.
Sorry.
Have I?
Yeah. I think you're getting into it. Can we stop the clock then?
Do you have any questions?
Elizabeth, can we? I'll give you 5 minutes because that was running.
Oh, okay.
All right.
If the court has any other questions about the issues, I'll answer them now or I'll wait for my rebuttal.
I'd like to hear about grand larceny and robbery and whether one is a lesser included of the other. You can do that on rebuttal if
okay.
you prefer.
Okay, thank you. I'll do that. Thank you.
Good afternoon. You may please the court. My name is George Scarborough. I represent the state of Nevada respondent, and we respectfully request today that you affirm the appellant's judgment of conviction. Justice, I'm going to get right to your question. So we're focusing now on jury instruction 23. I think the crux of this entire analysis is shifting it to the Leonard instruction and the fixed locus and time element on whether or not Ms. Guidry completed this robbery. At the trial level, Mr. Mueller argued unsuccessfully, albeit, that this was an illegal action of replevin, meaning that Ms. Guidry, after taking the watch or having the watch in her possession, all of a sudden had a possessory right to defend herself or flee with this watch. The bottom line here is that her facilitating escape and driving away with that watch is a robbery. The Leonard instruction covers that. Not only does the Leonard instruction cover that, but the definition of robbery also covers the facts in this case. So jury instruction 23 highlighting the fact that she doesn't have a right to self or defend herself when she isn't lawfully in possession of the property, that the person who's using deadly force doesn't all of a sudden give her the right to use any type of force in exchange to escape, seems to be the crux of analysis that eliminates a lot of the problems and a lot of the issues that the defense is bringing up in these.
What about, though, the instruction 11? I'm concerned about that because it instructs on felony murder in the second degree. It completely instructs on felony murder, too, under subsection 2, where it says an unintentional killing is murder in the second degree. Unintentional killing occurring or committed in the prosecution of felonious intent. Now, that jury heard the indictment at the beginning of the trial, you know, the clerk of the court says a felony grand larceny, a felony leaving the scene. And you have a note that comes out that the jury's confused about, you know, they don't want to give felony murder one. They're not following your instructions. Clearly, they're going to compromise this. They're already confused, it sounds like. And now we have felony murder two instruction, and you only instruct them that robbery is first degree murder. You don't put another instruction there saying grand larceny and leaving the scene cannot be considered for murder in the second degree. It's missing that. How is this not legally wrong, this instruction?
Well, Justice, I don't think we were pursuing the second degree murder theory.
But you instructed them on murder too without clarifying.
Because I believe that's actually them reaching a compromise. They wanted to compromise.
How can we be sure, though, that it's not based on this instruction telling them that they can come back with murder, too, on those two felonies?
I think it's evidenced by the exact question that they asked, by them asking, hey, if we have to find the robbery, do we have to find the felony murder? I think it actually demonstrates a nuanced understanding of the distinction between the two and them recognizing that maybe they don't want to convict this defendant of a first-degree murder because of the stiffness of it or any other consideration that may have invaded their thoughts.
Well, but what if somebody said, well, wait a second, we're in the commission of the prosecution of felonious intent. We can't be sure that they didn't just go back to this instruction. What was the court's ruling after they asked that question? What did the court instruct them?
I believe it was just to direct them back to the instructions.
Right.
They didn't supplement any because the court properly didn't supplement any of the instructions. Now, I believe that the instruction number 11 clearly defines the parameters and clearly separates what the first degree felony murder theory is in the robbery in terms of what doesn't constitute the second degree murder. I understand
Mr. Scarborough, this is Justice Kadish in Carson City. Hi. So why, if the state was not pursuing at all a theory of felony second degree murder, why was the jury even instructed on it at all?
Because I believe it was offered on the verdict form. We knew it would be offered on the verdict form, so we would have
but
to instruct.
Second degree murder was on the verdict form. That why is paragraph 2 there at all?
I'm so sorry, Justice. Paragraph 2 of
instruction number 11. In other words, paragraph 1 is about malice murder, second degree murder, and paragraph 2 is about second degree felony murder. I think what you said is state wasn't pursuing a theory of a felony second degree. I understand you were arguing for first degree. I got that. But once you have a transition instruction and you talk about what's required for second degree murder, why are you even talking about second degree felony murder if that's not a theory being pursued?
Well, the reason I believe jury instructions are also given are not just to clarify strictly offense by offense, but it's also to delineate the parameters in which other offenses can specifically blend into other ones.
But so, you instructed on felony murder too. This comes right from the statute, which is fine, except for you didn't charge felony murder too at all. So my understanding of this case is the defense didn't object to a murder in the second degree verdict form because the state, even in closing, was saying, well, look, you know, they were doing the bootstrap with the involuntary statute, which then bootstraps into murder too about reckless disregard for human life. But here you clearly, clearly instruct on felony murder in the second degree. Without any, and you take the time, however, if the felony is robbery, the crime is murder in the first degree. You've left off, you know, at least explaining to the jury that they cannot come back with the murder in the second degree with a finding of grand larceny or leaving the scene of the accident. That is clearly missing from this instruction after you've instructed them on murder in the second degree, felony murder.
I mean, that's fair, Justice, and I think that this is just an accurate statement of law. We're not going to supplement or add any other crimes or anything else like that. That may be a misstatement of the law. So as Your Honor had just indicated, it's from the statute, and we pulled that from the statute, and we instructed on the parameters of any potential maybe involved or related theory that the jury could or could not understand or grasp, and that's why we submitted that.
On instruction 11, subsection 2, how did that convey to the jury that it must find that the defendant acted with malice aforethought? How is that concept in that subparagraph 2?
Well, I wouldn't say that it was in subparagraph 2. The instructions are usually taken together as a whole. So as I flip through my notes, as we go to volume, I believe, 2, part 1, and I'm looking for, and I believe the pages is 331, implied malice versus express malice is actually defined in another instruction that we are given. So those concepts of express and implied aren't just dropped in one instruction and then all of a sudden never mentioned and or defined or clarified in another one. Amongst the murder instructions that we typically give, we did actually give the typical implied malice versus express malice in the definition. So I believe you're correct. While it's not in that specific instruction, it is in that packet where the juries can flip to other areas and then define terms of art or important terms. So I would say that it was.
Mr. Scarborough, I'm not sure if it was you. I believe it might have been in your initial closing argument to the jury. You argued to the jury, based on this language, maybe from the involuntary manslaughter instruction where that very similar language is, that by opening up the car full throttle when someone's trying to stop you, that floors it, goes full throttle, the victim on the hood, that makes it not involuntary manslaughter, and it's actually murder. I mean, weren't you actually arguing for second-degree felony murder without having pled that theory?
I mean, I was arguing the instructions of the unintentional killing and the commission of an unlawful act which naturally destroys the life of a human being, hinting, if I remember correctly, and I don't mean to misquote myself, but in terms of opening up the throttle is my argument in terms of the commission of the unlawful act that naturally destroys the human life, the life of a human being. So understanding that, you know, we're pursuing the first degree felony murder theory, but the instructions that are given back to the jury, I'm arguing facts and clarifying facts that could arguably apply to each of those instructions.
So following up on Justice go ahead.
No, it's Justice fine. Justice Silver, go ahead.
Following up on Justice Pickering's question, there were a number of jurisdictions, including the Eighth Circuit, Florida, I think South Carolina, in which was referenced in the appellant's brief that larceny is, in fact, a lesser included of robbery. It's the taking. Why wouldn't we follow that, and why wouldn't we just vacate the grand larceny here? I've never seen in 33 years both of these pled at the same time. Your theory was robbery, not grand larceny. It's a robbery. That's what you argued to the jury. In fact, to get murder in the first degree, right? Felony murder. Shouldn't this grand larceny be vacated based on all of the law throughout the country?
Justice, I don't think it should. The grand larceny and the robbery clearly pass the Blockberger test. There's elements of grand larceny that aren't contained in the robbery, such as the force, such as the value. And with all due respect, our theory was, in order to get to the first degree murder, the robbery as being the predicate felony. You are absolutely correct on that. But we are also pleading, and what our theory was, is that it was a grand larceny by taking the watch off, and it turned into a robbery by her facilitating the use of her vehicle to...
But on a Blockberger analysis, what is it that makes larceny not a lesser included of robbery? You're saying the value issue. They're arguing that's really a sentencing type of guideline. I get that it seems to be an element in the crime. And so you're saying that's the, you know, like on the Venn diagram, that's the part that doesn't double up?
No, actually, and forgive me for misspeaking. I believe that what the central thrust of the analysis in the Blockberger test and what differentiates grand larceny and robbery is it's not the value, it's the violence. You can commit.
Well, violence differ. That makes robbery requires violence, whereas grand larceny does not. But grand larceny would have to include something that robbery does not in order to be a lesser included of robbery. So what does grand larceny include that robbery doesn't?
The intent to permanently deprive. So in terms of, I don't believe that the grand larceny is, I don't want to incorrectly quote it's not subsumed by the robbery. In other words, you can commit a grand larceny or a larceny and not commit the robbery. And that was our theory of the case, and that's what the facts showed. We believe that she committed the grand larceny that ultimately turned into, illegally under the law, a robbery.
How is this not double jeopardy when you are punishing, and in fact, she got consecutive time here for the same act, number one. Number two, tell me one other Nevada case in which both stood. Not a plea, but a jury trial, where these if this is so common and so normal and so grand larceny, because every single thing would be charged. Every single thing would be you know, every time somebody goes into Walmart, you'd have a grand larceny, they took the stuff, and then they walk out and they fight with the guard, every single case will be pled. Grand larceny robbery, every single one. Tell me one other case in Nevada where it's pled and it's been upheld.
I can't think of one off my head, Justice, I understand that. In terms of what the double jeopardy comes into play is, again, it's these are two different offenses, and she's not being punished for the same offense. I understand
that. It's the same Rolex watch. You're being punished for taking a Rolex watch, whether she did it by force or whether she did it surreptitiously. She's being punished two times for taking the same item. How is that not double jeopardy under the law, under state and federal constitutions?
Because punishing someone for the surreptitious taking of the watch is not the same as punishing them for taking it with force. And I understand that you have questions. I don't want to waste the remaining of my time. I think I just want to hit on the Runyon's instructions were accurate. That was an accurate statement of the law. The necessity instruction was absolutely not borne out by the facts. I want to make sure that the necessity instruction is addressed because that does go to the central defense theory of the duty to stop. In the appellant's reply brief, they're saying that the Runyon instructions and the self-defense and necessity only applies to the murder. Well, they offered the necessity instruction for the duty to stop. And quickly, as I run out of time, the duty to stop, there's a duty to stop once you get to a safe place. Once you get to a safe place, then you report. That goes into the necessity argument where she was in fear for her own safety, and that's why she didn't stop. But the evidence in the case shows that moments after she flees that scene and strikes him with her car, which is a collision or a crash, and that's a nominal difference, she pulled over at a gas station, I believe, the gas station being irrelevant in part, and she contacted the fence for Miami. She could have reported that, and she didn't. That's why the necessity instruction was appropriately denied.
Justice Silver, can I ask another question, though we're about to run out?
Sorry. Of course.
While I understand that a person has the right to resist the taking of their property, and so in this case we have the Rolex watch, is it your position that a victim of a taking can use deadly force to resist that taking or to prevent the escape?
It's reasonable force, and I would submit that based on the facts in this case, we see no deadly force by an individual jumping in front of a moving car and trying to stop it. I understand that there's evidence that shows that he may have been pounding on the windshield and possibly pounding on the driver's side door, but it's a reasonable force, and this was far from deadly in the state's.
Was the jury instructed that the force had to be reasonable?
I believe so, that they had to be instructed that. I believe so. The long and short of the answer, that the force was defined.
I have a follow-up question, which is the same neighborhood as Justice Kiddush. May I ask it?
Yes.
I'm going back to instruction 23 and the second sentence of it, because the questions that Justice Kiddush was asking you lead to my concern with instruction 23, which read literally says to me that if I steal something and I'm trying to get away with it, and the person I've stolen from, there's been some break, and the person I'm stolen from is now chasing me with a gun, threatening to kill me if I don't give it back, that I don't have the right to self-defense. That's what that sentence seems to say. Do you have instruction 23 there?
Yes, and I have each of the clauses breaking down. So the second sentence that you're referring to, if I may.
Yes,
a person please. Who has taken property may not rely upon self-defense when the need to utilize the force is in response to the victim seeking to prevent the taking. Am I correct? Is that the sentence you're
yes.
referring to?
Or escape with the property. It continues.
It's an accurate statement of law. And when we're discussing the terms of whether or not there's a break, again, and this is why I opened with it, and I guess I'll end with it as well. The Leonard instruction really hones in on the fact of the fixed locus of time and that break analysis, where we can kind of come up with any type of fact where I take something surreptitiously and then 4 hours later, you come to me with a firearm to try to, get the property back or resist my taking of the property. The facts are simple in this case right here in terms of the break. The break was around 45 seconds. He was going to retrieve his property that she was escaping with, and he had the right, the absolute right under the law to resist that taking. And
understood,
that's what she was doing.
But this doesn't take into account if he pulls a gun on me for taking a Kleenex out of his pocket. In other words, wholly disproportionate but deadly force on the part of the victim.
Oh, okay. I understand what you're asking. It's a reasonable force standard, and obviously deadly force has to be evaluated in light of the circumstance in which deadly force needs to be used. But in terms of the instruction, going to the third sentence, in other words, the use of force by the person who has taken the property to escape with the property of another elevates it to taking a robbery. I know that's not contemplating the force that's proper, but when you look at the self-defense instructions again in whole, that also defines what reasonable force is in response to a situation where you're feeling compelled enough to use it. So the instructions here as a whole aren't leaving this concept absolutely barren and blank to the jury in terms of, well, whether or not, what if he pulled a gun? Would that have been reasonable force in response? That's all also explained and defined and in those Runyon instructions in terms of self-defense, because it also explains the appropriate and the proportionate use of force.
Well, Mr. Scarborough,
instruction
number 18, one of the self-defense instructions, says in its fourth paragraph, notwithstanding, a person who is engaged in criminal activity must retreat instead of using deadly force. Now, it doesn't seem to specify, if the other person was using reasonable force or things like that. Does this not seem to tell the jury and that self-defense just can't apply because she took the watch?
Yes, because she's the initial aggressor, and that's the accurate statement of law. Yes, absolutely, and it should tell the jury that.
So by surreptitiously taking the watch without any, she didn't use any force when she took it that we know of, right? Any force that she, the only force she used is by use of the car. Is that your understanding?
To facilitate her escape with the property, yes, Justice.
Right. So she, yes. As far as we know, there's no evidence that she used any force other than by the car after he jumped on the car.
If you mean in terms of evidence of what happened inside the vehicle, I completely agree. But there is absolute evidence that she used force to get away with that watch by speeding and going away. And once he was in front of the vehicle,
flooring. So the force, the only force she used is with the car after he had jumped on it, right?
Yes, which killed him.
Of course. No, I definitely understand that. So the only force she used is after he jumped on the car.
Yes.
Okay.
When she floored.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, I have one more question too.
Of course.
Number 23 doesn't come from Runyon, does it? Where does that instruction actually come from? I was trying to figure out, I know a lot of times the state gives a set of instructions with all of the citations on it to the judge, and then they give the clean set to the judge. But I'm wondering where 23 even comes from.
You know what? That's an unfortunate oversight on me in terms of looking for the actual source. I remember Mr. DiGiacomo and I were crafting the jury instructions, and I could, to the best of my recollection, recall that we may have crafted this out of statements of law. But with all due respect, yes, I don't exactly remember specifically where we pulled this source. My memory is indicating to me that I believe it was a combination of factors, but I could be incorrect in all fairness.
Sure. And so you know what I'm talking about, the citation.
Would
that be in the court's file?
Yes.
I don't know if sometimes the court puts it on the left-hand side or not. Sometimes maybe they could throw them and just keep the clean ones. I just didn't know if you had citations or any document that would show where this came from.
Usually when we turn in the jury instructions with cites, we do that. That's on me for not remembering right now.
Sure. Thank you.
Your Honors, have any other questions? I believe. May I just briefly conclude? Or
I think we've taken enough time, but okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
All right. Ms. Dickinson.
So why isn't he right that on the lesser included larceny robbery as defined in Nevada, and I recognize the law from elsewhere, that larceny includes an element that robbery doesn't, and robbery includes one that larceny doesn't, the former being permanent intent to permanently deprive and the latter being violence. And then that would take it outside.
If you look at the larceny statute for grand and petty larceny, the elements are exactly the same. Intentionally steals, takes, carries away, leads away, or drives away, in this case, personal goods or property. He is arguing the intent to permanently deprive. That is not in the statute. That comes from case law. And it comes from the Harvey case. And in the Harvey case, the reason they start putting that in jury instructions is because they want to distinguish between somebody borrowing something and not bringing it back in time, or somebody just stealing. So that came out of case law, did not come out of elements that are in the statute.
Are you saying larceny isn't a specific intent crime?
It says specific intent to permanently deprive was not within the elements of the larceny statute, but we get that from case law under Harvey. And when we're looking at Blockberger, we're looking at the elements within the statute. And so that's why I was saying that.
But is there such an intent in robbery?
Intentionally take a
it's
robbery?
It's a general intent in Nevada.
I would say that when you use force to take something, even though that is not specifically the wording intent to permanently deprive, you know, you are intending to permanently deprive something. But so those specific words are not in the robbery statute, that's true, and they aren't in the larceny statute either. They come out of case law.
Are you arguing that grand larceny is a lesser included of robbery and that it's double jeopardy to convict of both?
Yes. Yes, I did. That was under issue three. If you look at the Martinez case in 1998, this court identified a robbery as a larceny with the use of force. So you would think that larceny would normally be considered a lesser included. However, the cases in the past have not indicated such. Hodges in 2019, an unpublished decision, said grand and petty larceny are not lesser included crimes of robbery because they can't contain a value element, but robbery does not. In the Williams case, the court acknowledged that robbery does not contain a value element. And in the Cleveland case in 1969, the court said the value of an item taken is a material allegation the state must prove. So this court has repeatedly said that it's not a lesser included because there's no value. But in the Grant case in 2021, the court found when the state failed to prove the value of goods as a Category B felony at the preliminary hearing, rather than dismissing the count, the district court could amend the information to a Category C. And when the court allowed that, they were treating it as a sentencing factor. I think the Olotabi case also suggests to us that it should be a sentencing factor. In Olotabi, the issue was the age of the sexual assault victim was in a different section of the statute, and the court came back and said, well, statutory sexual seduction is not a lesser included of sexual offense, and that the age was a sentencing factor. So taking that analysis to Chapter 205, the larceny, the time of at the time of the alleged crimes, the statutes contain the exact same definitions for larceny. And then in 1997, the legislature enacted 205.222, which contained different sentencing options for grand larceny. By doing this, I feel the legislature made it clear that value was a sentencing factor. That doesn't mean they don't have to prove it, we know under Prender you have to plead and prove. So if you look at the statute, and I'm saying if you just look at the statute the way it's pled, I mean, the elements are grand larceny would be a lesser included of robbery.
And that's because larceny is a lesser included of grand larceny.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Either of the justices have anything further to ask Ms. Dickinson?
No, thank you.
No, thank you.
Thank you so much for your arguments. We appreciate both counsel working on this, on these very good briefs, and we appreciate that. Thank you so much for your arguments today, and this matter is going to stand submitted, and we'll be in recess.